Welcome. Hare Krishna. Manu has invited me to speak, so I'm here today. And the title of my talk is The Journey from Vulture to Culture. Strange journey, huh? From vulture to culture. What does that mean? Well, the term vulture, very popular nowadays. Vulture funds and vulture this and vulture that. Do we aspire to become vultures? No, we don't. Vulture is people who are in it for themselves, to the neglect of others, to the detriment of others, not caring about others. As long as I get mine, that's what's important. That's vulture mentality, right? So I would probably suggest that most, if not all of you, are not really vulture by nature. I don't think you'd be sitting here, frankly. So how do we get from vulture to culture? There's a lovely verse. I want to start with a lovely verse. Actually, it's not a verse. It's a statement from Prabhupada. Prabhupada, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, our founder, Acharya, my guru. He said, in material life, one tries to become the master of everything. Everything and everyone. That's material life. In spiritual life, one tries to become the servant of everything and everyone. It's different. There is no struggle in becoming a servant, but there is great struggle in becoming the master. That's what he said. So here we try to learn how to become servants, how to become humble, and think about others. Does that mean we let people step on us? No, we don't advocate that, per se. But humble and serve, especially serve God, serve Krishna. So let's look at Brahma to Brahman. Brahman is, Brahmana is derived from the Sanskrit root brih. B-R-I-H, brih. To grow, to expand. And the second part of it is manas, man, brahman, manas, mind. That's manas. So Brahma, as we most of us know, is the creator. He is the personality who has created all of the diversity in the universe. That's Brahma. He's a finite personality. He's not an incarnation of God. He's a jiva, a soul, like you, like we are. But he's been elevated to this position of being a creator of all the life and all of the everything in the universe. But he's finite. Brahman, on the other hand, is spirit. Spirit is infinite, all-pervasive energy of God. That's spirit. Pervades everything. In Christianity, they call it Holy Spirit, Holy Ghost. Same. Without that, this whole world would immediately collapse, because that's the matrix upon which it is resting. Yeah? All creatures grow physically from birth, but there's a limit to the physical growth. And after a while, they begin to dwindle, degenerate, fall apart. Correct? Only humans are capable of limitless growth. Well, their bodies fall apart too. Not the body, the mind. The mind is capable of limitless growth. You can learn and grow using the mind right up to the point of death. Can you not? Lots of people do that. Prabhupada, when his body was falling apart right at the end, his mind was as sharp as a tack. Never slowed down mentally. Manas, or mind, is capable of introspection and imagination on an infinite level. We can rise up gradually to understand spirit, depending what level of consciousness we're on. When we are on a limited level of mundane or material consciousness, we can't fully grasp spirit or God. But we can aspire to that, and we can raise ourselves up through the mind. We can all do that. So one who uses these infinite possibilities of expanded imagination is effectively a Brahman, a spiritual person. Yeah, that's what it means, simply. So a Brahman seeks to move from the finite to the infinite, from restlessness. You know how restless humans are? From restlessness to peace. From insecurity to self-assurance. From manushya, human consciousness, to deva, godly or divine consciousness. And what is the Vedic mantra? Aham Brahmasmi. I am spirit. That's what it means. But we forget that we are spirit. Many people don't even know their spirit. And we limit ourselves within this little box with legs that we walk around in. Yet we are infinite beings. So let us use that imagination and that introspection. Now let's look at Shruti and Smriti. The Vedas are made up of, hundreds and thousands of volumes on every subject you can imagine. But they're divided into two categories. Shruti, that which is heard, Shruti, and Smriti, that which is remembered. So the various shastras or scriptures, writings, fall under those two categories, generally speaking. So what is Shruti? Shruti is a traditional method of receiving knowledge which is heard, which is received. It requires, usually, divya drishti, divine vision. Yeah. The ability to see that which cannot be seen with physical eyes. There are many things you cannot see with physical eyes. People say, well, seeing's believing. If I see it, I'll believe it. Otherwise, I don't believe it. Well, then you better put your phone down because you can't see your Wi-Fi signal. You can't see radio waves. You can't see microwaves. You can't see those waves. Yet they're there, right? Simple example. The ability to see that which cannot be seen with physical eyes, the invisible, the intangible. The ability to hear the silent inner voice. Yeah? This divya drishti is usually possessed by sages, rishis, rishi means sage, and seers. So one pretty much has to get to a reasonably elevated spiritual position before you start receiving on that wavelength, on that frequency. The word rishi, comes from drishti, to see. So that is what the Vedas, Veda means knowledge in science, and all the books of the Vedas, that's what it's based on. how did Brahma, the creator, get his information to make or create the creation? By meditating. When he came into consciousness, sitting on the lotus flower, he looked around himself and all he saw was pitch dark. He could see nothing. He couldn't see what was beneath him, even though he was sitting on a lotus flower, which was the umbilicus coming from the navel of Garbhodakshayi Vishnu. Couldn't see it. So he began to meditate, and he received all the information through meditation. It is also said that the entire Mahabharata was dictated to Vyasadeva, who wrote the Mahabharata, by Lord Brahma. So, Shruti is later transmitted. First of all, it was meditative. Through meditation, the knowledge came. The Veda came. Then it became a spoken word. It became an oral tradition. And people's minds back in the day, we're talking a lot of years ago, like millennia, were so sharp that they could hear a discourse on any subject once, and retain it all. Can you imagine? That you would remember everything you ever heard, especially something, you know, like you, excuse me, knowledge that you're trying to acquire, and you'd never forget. And then, over time, we became duller, denser, less sharp, and then what? Then we had to start writing it down, right? So we went from meditation to spoken word to written word. Shruti was later transmitted through mantra, prayers, shloka, verses, stuti, hymns, yantra, mystical diagrams. You know what yantras are? And lakshan. What is lakshan? Symbols. Symbols. Smriti, now a little bit different. Smriti is composed of stories connected to specific histories and geographies recalled through human memory. Smriti contains values, events, impressions relating to kala, desha, patra, time, place, circumstance. So it's unique to a particular location and period of time. That's smriti. Shruti, on the other hand, contains truths and values that are spiritual and transcendental in nature and origin. Hence, they are timeless and universal. So another way we could say it is what we're supposed to do, which I'm going to mention later, is to go from acquired knowledge to realized knowledge. From a knowing to an embodiment of the knowledge. So it becomes real for you. Becomes part of you. So from intellectual knowledge to wisdom, right? Now let's look at Western religions and Vedic spirituality. Western religions, such as Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, have a linear construct of life, beginning to end. You're born, you live for a while, you get old, you die, that's it, you're finished. One shot, you get one shot, it's over. How'd you do? And if you did well, you'll go to heaven. If you did badly, you'll burn in hell for eternity. Finished. That's pretty much how the Western construct is. Now, you can put that to the test if you want, but we don't believe that here. We do believe in the concept of heaven and hell, but not quite like that. So, what's the difference between Western religion and Vedic spirituality? Vedic spirituality is a cyclical construct. It's not linear. It's not a straight line. It's cyclical. In what sense? Srishti, Stiti, Pralaya. Creation, preservation, destruction, and again creation. Preservation, destruction. That is how it goes. That's the cycle. You don't believe me? Watch the seasons. Watch farmers. Generally, not in every place, obviously, they plant in spring and they harvest in fall. Correct? This is winter here. Well, a form of winter. Not like Canada, where I came from. But, you don't plant in winter. I mean, the ground's too cold and it's too frozen. You couldn't plant anything. Okay, so cyclical. And creation is also cyclical. Creations have a beginning, a middle, and an end. A cycle of creation. And it comes to an end. And then it goes into a period of dormancy for a time. It's said that Mahavishnu lies in mystic sleep, yoga nidra, and he dreams the creation. Mahavishnu is God. He dreams the creation. I love that. And he breathes out, exhales once. Out comes the whole creation, all this, and more. And then he inhales and it's gone into a state of dormancy. Do you see dormancy in our world? Give me an example of dormancy. Suspended animation. Winter. Right? Ireland's not the best example because it's green all year round. But you know, if you've been to different countries, trees lose their leaves and everything goes into dormancy until spring, and then we start again, right? Creation's the same. It's the same. As above, so below. It's not really hard to grasp this at all, is it? What does Krishna say? What's his comment on it from Bhagavad Gita? He says, Maya dyakshena prakriti suyate sachara acharam hetu nanena kaunteya jagat viparivartate. What does that mean? The material nature is working under my direction. This is Krishna speaking, God. Producing all moving and non-moving beings. They divide them into two categories, moving, non-moving. Well, that pretty much covers everybody, doesn't it? Producing all moving and non-moving beings. Under its influence, this material manifestation is created and annihilated again and again. Viparivartate. The root word of that is vart, which means to go, to move. And vipari means again and again and again, over and over. Endless. That's what it means. So, there it is. Now, let's compare them a little further. Western religions are prescriptive. Clear rules and conduct and codes of conduct, usually specific to Kala Desha Patra, time, place, circumstance. When Moses, apparently, according to the Old Testament of the Bible, when Moses came down off the mountain with the two tablets, he had the Ten Commandments etched on the tablets that God from the burning bush had given him. And one of them was, thou shalt not kill. These people had to be told, it's better you don't kill. Did you have to be told by your mother one day, please don't kill anyone? it's not a good idea. Did your mother sit you down and tell you that when you were a child? I don't think so. It was a different time. Those people had to be told, don't kill. Yeah, but still, I mean, there is killing going on. We know. It's not good. Not good. Vedic spirituality, yes, there are prescriptions and there are codes of conduct in Vedic spirituality, but that's not the focus. The focus is self-reflection. Spirituality is self-reflection. We want you to reflect and be and undergo your own realization. We want it to come from within and expand from within. So you get your own realizations, revelations, inspirations, insights, epiphanies. That's how Vedic spirituality works. Yeah? Meditative, philosophical, thoughtful, leading to realization, revelation. Shruti to Smriti. So, reflections such as this, spiritual reflections in life begin when? When we ask one question, one word. What is that word? Why? Why? Why this? Why me? What is all this about? What am I doing here? All right? That's when it begins. One becomes more spiritually inspired from that point forward. Because you want answers. How many times do you see people say, well, there are no answers to the reason we're here in our existence? How many times have I heard that from one character or another? Experts. Just because you don't understand it doesn't mean others do not understand it. Of course, you can't say that. It's not polite. Western religions are fear-based. Fear of punishment or hell. Retribution. God will smite you down. And Vedic spirituality is peace and love-based. Which do you want? If you look at the history of India, where Vedic spirituality comes from thousands of years ago, if it's truly peace and love based, tell me, how many countries did India invade since they came into being, historically? How many countries has India taken an army and invaded? None. Zero. If we want to expand it over to Buddhism, how many countries did the Buddhists go and invade and hit them over the head with the Buddhist stick? No, I don't think so. We don't do that in spirituality. We're not interested in that. We're not interested in vulture. We're interested in culture. So we seek enlightenment. Yeah, we may want redemption too, but redemption's not enough. You can ask God, oh, please just, you know, save me from, remove my sins and save me. That's fine. But, you know, that's like, I want you to do for me. I don't want to have to do anything myself. No. You have to. It's your duty to work on yourself spiritually and develop yourself so that you improve over time. Not just ask God to do it all for you, right? Where do you learn if something gets done for you and you never do it? It's nice when your mother cooks you dinners since you were a little child. You won't learn to cook that way, will you? Same idea. Western religions are sentimental. How do you know? Just tell them you disagree with them. And they'll get very upset and angry And then you'll ask them for philosophical reasons for this, but they don't have them because they're on the sentimental platform. They don't have, it's not that they don't have some philosophy, but most of them don't know it. So they're more sentimental. And here, it's more philosophical. We need to know. We want to know. And Western religions want to convert others. How many wars, my friends, historically have there been based in religion? And who does it better? Who goes to war better and more often than the Christians and the Muslims? Tell me. Is somebody I'm missing here? You know, you can't say anything. Then you're going to be in trouble. So Western religions want to convert others. They're always looking for converts. And Vedic spirituality wants simply to enlighten others. That's all. This is not a religion here, by the way. This is a yoga system. Yoga means linking the soul with God. This is yoga. This is not specifically an Ashtanga yoga system with asana and pranayama. Well, you can do that. That's fine. This is bhakti yoga. Yoga of love and devotion. Learning how to love. There's a great story about cyclical construct of life. And it's about, you'll find it in various places in the Vedas. Markandeya. Markandeya was a rishi. A sage. And he was blessed with immortality. So a lot of people think, that would be great. If I'm immortal, I'll never die. Only the problem was the pralaya came. The destruction of the universe came in the form of the great flood. Now, have you heard about the great flood? Of course you have. When everything gets inundated by the water. And all life disappears. It all comes to an end. You drown. Period. So there's floods, or sometimes it comes to the end through fire. They were testing that out in Australia recently, seeing how that would work. Works pretty good from that point of view. Yeah. So Markandeya found himself in the midst of this rising ocean of inundation, floating upon the ocean. He didn't sink. He didn't drown because he was immortal. But he was in a bit of a circumstance, you know, floating around on the waves. By the way, it's good to point out that the great flood that I'm talking about came thousands and thousands of years before Noah's Ark. Okay? To the Vedas, much older. So he witnessed the pralaya, Markandeya, the dissolution of the creation, and lived to tell the tale. The floodwaters rose, swallowed up the forests, the mountains, and even the continents. Although fearful of his life, the waters of destruction did not drown Markandeya. He mysteriously floated upon them. Then he saw a very strange sight. He saw floating on a banyan leaf a little baby. Baby Krishna, or baby Vishnu, depending where you read it, God. A little baby, and he was gurgling and laughing, and he had his foot in his mouth, he had his right toe in his mouth. And he was floating on this banyan leaf, top of the waters of destruction. The child inhaled deeply. And through his nostril in went Markandeya. Like this. And now he's in the body of God, this little baby. He's in his body. Within the baby's body, Markandeya saw the entire creation. All the planetary systems, the oceans, the mountains, the forests, the rivers, all types of living entities, living creatures, plants, animals, humans, devas, asuras, nagas, rakshasas, yakshas, apsaras, gandharvas. Gandharvas, apsaras are like angels. It was as if the pralaya, the destruction, had never happened. Everything was intact inside the body of God. In this, as he appeared at this moment as a baby. Everyone lived as before, oblivious of the great calamity taking place outside the child's body. They were oblivious. They didn't know what was going on. They were all just life scaring on as usual. Barkindaya realized that outside the baby's body was death, and inside was life. As long as he was outside, Markandeya experienced fear and insecurity. But inside, he experienced wonder, security, and peace. He then realized that the baby was God himself. Krishna taking the form of a baby represents what? Why is God taking the form of a baby? Because the baby represents renewal and innocence. The world collapses when innocence and purity is lost. If you look historically at any great civilization, when they come to the end, when they start to decline, that's when they become more corrupt. There's more hypocrisy. And they lose their purity and their truth and their morality. Have you seen any decline in morality lately? I think maybe somewhat, yeah? I think maybe a lot. Welcome to Kali Yuga. So, the world collapses when innocence and purity is lost, when corruption corrodes society. Pralaya, or death, is a metaphor, marking the moment when everything around us collapses. That's death. All structures break down, nothing remains to support us. We are left with nothing to cling to. The only thing that can take us through this storm, like a raft, like the banyan leaf afloat on the waves, is our what? Shraddha. Faith. Faith in God. Spiritual faith. Faith in the fact that you are a soul. You are pure spirit. And the connection you can develop or establish with God is entirely up to you. It's there for you anytime. Faith is a force that defies all transformations. It is a state where there is no death, no change, no transformation, and no fear. Only peace, serenity, and immortality. Let's look at the three methods now of fulfilling goals and desires. Goals, objectives, desires. Free will, based on the fact that we all have free will, we exert human effort. We make efforts toward different things that we want to achieve, we want to develop, we want to learn, we want to have. Right? Number two, fate or destiny. Based in what? Based in past karma. In this lifetime, you are here to fulfill desires. Whose desires are they? They're yours. You can take ownership anytime. They're yours. You're here. That's why you got a body, to fulfill desires and to receive your karma from the last life. So that's your fate. And the third is the grace of God. Is that another way to fulfill desires and reach goals? Yeah. Are most people aware of that? I don't think so. Doesn't seem like it. Bhakti rasa. Going into a relationship of love and devotion with God. That's how you get the grace of God. There's a great verse here from the Niti Shastra. The fulfillment of an action depends on two factors. Destiny and human effort. Destiny is the current manifestation of the human effort from past lives. Did you get that? Destiny, things that are coming to you of their own accord. And you meet up and somehow things just work out. You catch a break. Doors open. People show up. Boom. Wow. I don't know what just happened. I got this, met this person, and then a couple of phone calls were made and I got a job. I was so worried I wouldn't get a job, and somehow it just, that's an example. That's from, because of human efforts from a past life. Okay? As a chariot cannot move with only one wheel, destiny is not fulfilled without human effort. One wheel is human effort. The other wheel is destiny. When you see a chariot move or a wagon, do these wheels not move simultaneously together? Of course they do. That's how it works. So you can't just say, I'm going to sit back here and let fate come and serve me. Serve it up, please. I'm ready. No, it doesn't work like that. You have to exert the effort as well, right? That's the balance. Human effort can never overcome destiny. Yeah, no, this is an interesting point. In the New Age movement or human potential movement, they always say you can create your own reality. Is that true?
No.
Well, it is to a certain extent. I mean, if you want something, you can have it. You can bring it in. Dependent on what? Dependent on your karma. If it goes against your karma, that is your destiny, then it won't work. You know, a lot of people say they take these courses with these extreme multimillionaires who are going to teach you how to make millions like I have. That's not me saying that, by the way. I don't have millions. But I have been doing Vedic astrology now for 43 years, and I've seen thousands and thousands of charts of people from all around the world. And if that is a map of your karma, that shows fate and destiny. And if in your birth chart it doesn't indicate that you're going to become a millionaire or a multimillionaire, then guess what? And it's not to say that you can't accumulate some money, but you're not going to be able to become a millionaire. Because it's not in your karma. There's a great story from the Vedas to illustrate fate. One time, the gods decided to visit Mount Kailas, which is where Shiva lives. You know Shiva? Shiva is the king of the yogis. Shiva is also in charge of pralaya, of destruction or dissolution of the universe when the time comes. It's not like he's always busy destroying things. He's not. And he's a great personality. He's Vishnu Shakti. He's God energy. He's God. So the various gods came to visit Shiva and Kailas. Brahma came on his swan carrier. Indra came on his elephant. Agni came on his ram, Agni the fire god, Chandra the moon god on his antelope, Vishnu, God himself, that's another manifestation of God, came on Garuda, his eagle carrier, and Yama, god of death and retribution, came on his buffalo. Apparently he was a little late because buffaloes are a bit slow, is what they said. As Yama entered the gate, he saw a sparrow sitting on the ledge of the gate. And he kind of looked at him and he frowned a bit. And Garuda saw Yama looking at him and he thought, oh no, this Yama's gonna, he's the god of death. He's going to take this sparrow. He's going to put an end to his life. I'm going to rescue him. Garuda is very powerful. He's not like just an eagle. He's half man, half eagle. So Garuda decided he would rescue him. So he took the little sparrow and he flew south over seven rivers. It said seven rivers and seven hills, and finally came down to the Dundak Forest. You know the Dundak? Where do we know the Dundak Forest from? The Ramayana. That's where Ram went, to the Dundak Forest, right? And there in the Dundak Forest was an ashram of the sage Pipalad. Generally, yogis' ashrams are very peaceful and lovely and beautiful, and flower-bearing trees, and it's wonderful energy. And he placed the sparrow on the branch of a mango tree. And the sparrow was chirping happily on the branch of the mango tree, and Garuda thought, very good, I've done my duty. Yama's not going to get him. And he flew back to Kailas. Shortly, the meeting adjourned, and the gods were coming out to leave. And Yama was walking alongside Vishnu. And Yama, he looked at that same ledge where the sparrow was and was no longer. And he smiled ever so slightly. And Vishnu said, why are you smiling? And Yama told him about the sparrow who had been on the ledge when they all arrived. And he said, but the sparrow was destined to die today in the Dundak Forest, at the ashram of the sage Pipalada, in a mango tree, where he would be eaten by a python. And the reason I frowned was because, what's he doing here, up at Kailas? So now I realize that that's exactly what happened. He was down in the Dundak Forest in the mango tree. And Yama was worried about the repercussions that would take place if the sparrow did not die at the appointed hour in the appointed place. But somehow things had gone as planned, and his karmic books were balanced. That's why he smiled. And there was Garuda, dumbfounded. What have I done? I've taken this little sparrow to its death. So Garuda caused the python to be fed. That was a hungry python, ate the sparrow, and the sparrow to meet his death, in spite of himself. So, but Garuda was only the instrument in the fate of the sparrow. Good story. We cannot escape our fate, my friends. When your time for death comes, it comes. We know from the Vedas that we have so many breaths assigned to us. And when your number of breaths are exhausted, you're finished. You don't get an extra breath, you know. You can't.
Please, can I buy 5 breaths?
No, sorry. Doesn't work like that. That's why I tell my clients who are marathon runners, not a good idea, my friend. It's a lot of breaths you're wasting there. You're going to use up those breaths in no time. Walk. That's my advice. Just walk. And of course, if they don't believe that this is true, then it doesn't matter. Still going to run the marathon. There was a poor Brahmin priest. Now we're going to talk about abandoning Dharma to chase Dana. Abandoning your duty, your obligation, your life purpose, your code of conduct, your path of virtue to chase money, to chase wealth. Have you seen anybody, do you know anybody who's done that with their lives? Oh, I dare say you do. One or two people. We might even look in the mirror. There he is now. We may have done that ourselves on occasion, correct? So there was a Brahmin priest who was very poor and no longer able to bear his poverty. So he went to the temple and he prayed to the deity. You know what the deity is? The gods on the altar, that's the deity. God takes the form of the deity so we can see him. I know they're statues, I'm well aware. But God can take any form he wants if he chooses. So he can also express himself through those forms. So he went to the temple, he prayed to the deity for a solution to his problem of poverty. That night, the deity left a golden pot in the courtyard of the priest's home. The next day, when he woke up, the priest discovered the golden pot in his courtyard with some water in it. He was overjoyed. My prayers have been answered. So what did he do? He threw out the water. And he took the pot down to the market where he sold the pot to a merchant. Golden pot. With the money he received, he paid all his debts, returned home a rich man bearing gifts for all of his family members. Very pleased with himself. Soon after, as happens, my friends, when money arrives, when money appears, people go a little crazy. I cannot tell you how many stories of clients of mine that fight over money, especially when somebody dies and there's a will, a legacy. Well, you don't have to die. They'll fight when you're alive too, but, you know, it brings confusion. It brings confusion. Look what happens to these people who win the lottery. And they go in the newspaper, they go on TV, and they got the big check. You know, it's this size. And look, I won. This is me. I live in such and such a place. That phone will not stop ringing at their house. With people, perfect strangers with great ideas that could use some of that money. This is a fact. What to speak of all the rallies. The relatives will come out of the woodwork. Believe me. You're related to me how? I'm the second cousin of the son of the brother of your former uncle. Oh, yeah, right. Never heard of you. So they begin to argue, fight over the vast wealth. Everyone from his wife to his children to his parents to his siblings demanded their share. Unable to bear this mental agony, which went on for quite some time, the priest returned to the temple and he complained. You ever get mad at God? Complain to the deity. How dare you? The golden pot you gave me has only multiplied my problems. I got more problems than ever now. And the deity replied, what golden pot? I gave you the elixir of peace and contentment inside the pot. It just happened to be a pot of gold. What did you do with the elixir of peace and contentment? I threw it out. Oh. You drank it? No. Oh. So the key thing that he was given to solve his problems, he got confused. He went off the path of Dharma and went to Dana. Look at all this money. And did it bring peace and contentment to his family? Quite the opposite, my friends. Quite the opposite. We must do our best to stay on the path of Dharma. I wanted to say this. This doesn't exactly fit into what I've been talking about, but it's such a wonderful statement that I wanted to share it with you. What is hell? We talk about hell. Sometimes we tell people, go to hell. Hellish state. We all want to avoid hell or a hellish state of mind or a hellish existence. There's various kinds of hell. We've all had a taste of hell at various times. Can you experience hell while you're on earth? Oh, yes, my friends. There are different war zones and countries you can go to right now. That's hell. It's no different than hell. All right? So what is hell? Simply, hell is the separation from your true love. What do you mean? Separation from my girlfriend? From my wife? From my spouse? From my children? No. Inevitably, that you may have a true love in your wife or your husband, but they won't be there forever. They'll die, or you'll die, or the relationship will end before you die. And then you'll have to find a different true love. So who's your true love? It's Krishna. That's the only true love. That's the unconditional love. That's the love that goes on forever. It's eternal. That's the eternal love. That's the love we tried to cultivate and develop here. That's true love. That's bhakti. Love and devotion for God, for Krishna. Okay, concluding. We must go from vulture to culture. We must not try to manipulate, control, intimidate, take advantage of, victimize, mistreat, verbally abuse, emotionally abuse, physically abuse others. That's vulture mentality. We must raise ourselves up through culture. Through what kind of culture? Spiritual culture. From vulture to culture, from dominance to dharma. Dharma is what? Giving, not taking. Duty to the whole world, not just duty to yourself, your family. Duty to everyone. We have a duty to everybody, to all of us. Not just the people you're related to. Love for all, not power for a few. Affection, not domination. The true victor manipulates no one, nor is manipulated by anyone. That's the victor. That's victory. I thank you for your kind attention. Hare Krishna. Questions?
How do we do? daily vulture funds.
Elect a different government. How do you deal with vulture funds? I mean, you know, vulture funds means people who are investing in certain things simply to make money. And if there's a human consequence, it's going to cause a detrimental effect to humans on the other end of, on the receiving end or the other end of that transaction. That doesn't matter. We don't care about that. All right? We don't care about those consequences as long as I get mine. How to deal with it? By enlightening people. If you're people who have money in vulture funds generally operate out of fear. Now, I'm not going to criticize people for investing their money, okay, so don't get me wrong. But many people operate out of fear. The stock market, which is, speculative investment, is based on what two emotions? Fear and greed, right? And however much you got, it's not enough. Have another go at it here. Gee, it feels good. I need to make some more. This just feels too good. And then maybe it doesn't work out. So the only way to deal with it properly is to enlighten people. That's what I'm sitting here humbly trying to do, is to enlighten a couple of people. You know, if you take one thing away, one thing that's been said, I'm so happy. One thing of value. Then I've done my job. Any other questions, comments?
Prabhu, what can we do in our day-to-day activities to develop that kind of consciousness which helps us to understand that real dharma?
You always ask me that, Prabhu. You asked me it last time. You know what to do. Chant. Meditate. Get close to Krishna. Treat everybody kindly, respectfully. Everyone. Doesn't matter where they come from. We come across people all day long, every day. On the train, on the tram, on a bus, on an airplane, walking down the street. There's thousands of them out there right now. Just treat them nicely, with kindness, with understanding. Look at them. See them. But just don't get all wrapped up in your own little world. Right?